We have finally arrived at Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi, the founder of Chabad. He is an extraordinarily interesting character, and I think he could best be described as the CEO of Hasidic history, because it's really quite impressive what he did. So we'll spend a little bit more time on his biography before we get to a little bit of an overview of the Tanya, at least to the best of my ability. And then if we have time, we'll learn one of his letters that were collected. So let's do a little bit of his biography. He was one of the youngest students of the Maggid of Mezrich. He was also one of the leading interpreters of his Torah. He gained fame very quickly as a Maggid. He was known for being an exceptional speaker, very engaging, very clear, concise and to the point. And hundreds of people, maybe even thousands, would come from all over to hear him speak even before he had a court. If you remember from when we did Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, so Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk ended up making Aliyah. He moved to the land of Israel, along with two other major Hasidic rabbis. They were the leading students of the Maggid at the time. And when they left, there was really a vacuum in leadership. They try to lead their Hasidim from Eretz Yisrael by sending letters, mostly by sending letters. I wish they had, if they were coming to their Hasidim in dreams, I'm not aware of it. But they would send numerous letters. But as we all know, even with the internet now, it's very hard to lead from afar.
Was this coincidental that two of them left, or was it a theme of the Maggid that he wanted his students to go and live in?
I mean, Jews have been dreaming of living in the land of Israel. There was a messianic fervor that went along with the Hasidic movement. So to make Aliyah would not be the oddest thing in the world for them to do. It put a lot of pressure on Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi. The reason it put a lot of pressure on Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi, I'll pause for the moment. The fact that these three Hasidic rabbis who were major leaders of the community in Lithuania at the time had made Aliyah put an immense amount of pressure on Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi, and he found himself raising money for this kind of new burgeoning community in the land of Israel, which didn't really burgeon for the next 150 years, but it was burgeoning for a long time. But he ultimately, because of this vacuum in leadership, becomes the natural leader of Lithuanian Hasidism. And he becomes extraordinarily popular. Popular in such a way that he is attracting people who were once classical Lithuanian Jews, who were once followers of the Vilna Gaon, who were once part of the Mithnagdic community. And as one could imagine, that caused a great uproar. And the worst thing is, when your enemy is a ne'er-do-well, so you can deal with it. You know, if you're the roadrunner and you're always fighting against Wile E. Coyote, so you know in the end of the day you'll survive. You know, that's what it comes down to. But what if it's the roadrunner against Speedy Gonzalez? You know, so all of a sudden you have a someone to really counterbalance the influence of the Vilna Gaon. So as you can imagine, he attracted a lot of criticism. And famously, on May 8th of 1798, I brought it down here, he was accused of supporting the revolution in France. This is from Russia's perspective, the last thing they want is French interlopers. And, you know, that's going to come to a head in 1812 when Napoleon is going to try to take Russia. And we'll see how the Rebbe gets himself involved in that also. But he's accused of supporting the revolution in France. The Russians investigate into the Rebbe's various dealings, and they find, by the way, one of the fascinating things is that in the Chabad libraries, they have the Rebbe's interviews with the Russian authorities. which are pretty fascinating. I read a bunch of them. But they were trying to figure out, like, if he was doing anything subversive, and they're asking him, and he's like, I give classes. I try to inspire people. I'm not trying to lead any revolution here. And then he was accused of founding a new religion, which, you know, they were official and recognized religion. And he says, no, I'm following a traditionalist religion of Judaism. We just, you know, we have a little bit of a different take on it. He's extraordinarily eloquent and well-spoken. It's clear the whole time that the Rebbe is careful with his words about what he will and won't say. But in any case, the Russians, when they investigate him, they find that he's sending funds to Jews in Turkey. So, and in Israel. That's where he's sending funds to, because he wants to support Jews in the land of Israel. So Israel is ruled by the Ottomans. The Russians, particularly Tsarist Russia, their main enemy is the Ottomans. So this gets the Rebbe in trouble, and he's arrested. And for a while, he is placed in jail until November 16th, 1798. You can see it's for a good few months. Yud Tes Kislev, which is to this day a Chabad holiday. They don't say Tachnun. It's a, you know, they Fabreng. It's a very big deal. This is the day that the Alter Rebbe was released and acquitted of all charges. And he was free, really, to work for a while until Napoleon invades Russia in 1812. I assume we're all aware that Napoleon was one of the many who failed. But at the time, people thought he was going to be successful in 1812. Rushner Zalman is helping to move his Hasidim deeper and deeper into Russia to escape potential suffering or being in the way in the war. And he makes a deal with the Russians that he's going to spy on Bonaparte on behalf of the Tsar. This whole thing took an immense amount out of him, and he dies before 1812 is over. So this is kind of his life in a nutshell. He goes from, again, one of the youngest students of the Maggid of Mezrich into becoming probably one of, if not the most influential leader of his day. How did he reach such heights? So number one is he was the CEO of Hasidic Rebbes. I don't know how else to define it. But here was an individual who had, aside from being an immense Talmid Chacham, who had superb and stupendous organizational skills. He recognized that he was more than the ad hoc leader of an ad hoc movement, but he was the leader of a movement which required an administrator and an organization. And so, number one is, if you read through his letters, he's a rejecter of miracle working that was popular in Ukraine and in Polish Hasidim. He is more into Rebbes are teachers, that Tzaddik is there as an intermediary, he's there to inspire, he's there to guide. But if you're looking for someone who's going to, you know, perform a miracle on your behalf, to be a Baal Shem in the style of the Baal Shem Tov, you came to the wrong place. As we saw, he's also active in the political realm. He fosters relationships with the Russian government, with the Tsarist government, with the local governments. He reached a point where in Lubavitch, where he has his court, where he was an official rabbinic figure. And so that was also important, and he becomes a very, very valuable for everybody interlocutor with the authorities there. He's someone who's, like I said, he was well-spoken, and he was someone who was able to really be a wonderful advocate on behalf of the entirety of the Jewish community. Interestingly, there is lore, although it's not proven, that he attempted to gain an audience with the Vilna Gaon. He worked very hard to try to gain an audience with the Vilna Gaon in order to convince the Vilna Gaon that, you know, we can all get along here. We can all be friends. We're on the same team. He believed And this is actually true in actuality, that there was a lot of overlap between the Vilna Gaon's Kabbalah and Hasidic Kabbalah, and there was what to talk about in terms of forging relationships, but the Vilna Gaon refused to see him. The story goes is that the Rebbe said that his one regret in life was that he didn't try to break the door down to speak to the Vilna Gaon. So again, whether that story is true or not, it certainly could have been true, because he was definitely an individual who valued the opportunity to dialogue with others, and this was one of his potential areas where he might have been successful. So let's talk about his organization. So number one is he separated. Everyone wanted a yechidus with the Rebbe. That's one of the great things you can get, which is personal time with the Rebbe. And then what happened with other Hasidim is some people would get more time with the Rebbe than others, and you know that's not fair because everybody wants an opportunity to interact with the Rebbe. So what he did was he started differentiating between what he called yeshanim and chadashim. Yeshanim were people who had already had an audience with the Rebbe. Chadashim were individuals who had not yet had an audience with the Rebbe. And then he separated his Shabbases. There were Yeshanim Shabbases, and there were Chadashim Shabbases. Obviously, there were more Chadashim Shabbases than there were Yeshanim Shabbases. Why? To give an opportunity for people who had not yet had a chance for Yechidus with the Rebbe to have Yechidus with the Rebbe. So he creates this kind of organization. He also has a group of gabayim, individuals who it was their responsibility to basically organize who gets to see the Rebbe and when, and this way they can control it. Because we were talking about an individual who was attracting thousands of people to his court on a weekly basis, and that's going to put a lot of pressure on him. The letters were extraordinarily helpful. He writes a lot of letters to different areas, to different people. He created systems for how the court should work, and he even created a system for how to support his chassidim. One of the responsibilities of the Rebbe was that poor chassidim needed to be supported, but also the Rebbe needs to get a salary. So where do you get all these things? So he separated donations into two types of donations. There were ma'amados and there were pidyonos. Ma'amados is taxes. Every person who is a Chabad Chassid, they pay a tax called a maimid. That maimid, that would pay for the Rebbe's salary and any administrative needs for the Rebbe's court. Okay, that's what it would pay for. He was also, like I said, he was an official rabbi, so he made a little money that way also. Then you had pidyonos, which is every time an individual would have an opportunity to meet with the Rebbe, and this was true across the Hasidic world, you would pay a pidyon, right? What does pidyon mean? Like if I want to pay pidyon nafsho, right? If I want to pay off, to preserve my own life, so that was the pidyon. The pidyonos money was not required. Only if you could pay, you would give pidyonos money, and the entirety of the pidyonos money would go towards supporting poor chassidim. Okay, so in this way he was able to differentiate it, and you knew what your money was going for. Again, he's an administrative master. Not only is he an administrative master, he's also a wonderful darshan and an educator. So number one is, you're already realizing by this point, because the Hasidus is coalescing into a movement, that the halacha that the Hasidim are following, you know, with its kind of mystical bent, that halacha is slightly different than the halacha that's being followed in the non-Hasidic world. So the Vilna Gaon writes his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law. Rav Shneur Zalman of La'adi writes his own Shulchan Aruch Harav. That's what it's referred to as, the Shulchan Aruch Harav. It's built and it's organized exactly like the main Shulchan Aruch. Overall, the overlap is, shall we say, 90%. Maybe there's a 10% different. But there he puts out what becomes his halachic opinions. Among them, famously, is not to sit in a sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. which was the opinion of the Hasidim. Just so you're aware, the Vilna Gaon used to sleep in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres in Lithuania, just to prove that that you're supposed to sit in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. Which it's cold in Lithuania on Sukkot time, really cold. So, but the Vilna Gaon was trying to make a point that he did that, and the other legend has it that before Pesach he would boil a gigantic matzo ball and place it in his window to show that he ate kebrachs. So that was the other. So you could see the Vilna Gaon was taking on those positions. That being said,
that was from the Vilna Gaon, the matzo ball.
Yeah, again, I think it's legend, but for
from,
sure
not from Lubavitch.
No, for sure he ate he ate in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres though. Yeah, my rule.
Hasidim don't eat kebrach.
What Hasidim? Most Hasidim don't eat kebrachs. Correct. And the practice of not sitting in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres is also a Hasidic practice, which I always tell people. I said you cannot sit in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres if you dance like a Hasid on Simchas Torah. That's my rule. Okay, but you got to have it both ways. If you're going to be a Hasid. You know, that's my rule.
Or even on Shmini Atzeres.
Fine. You know, I'll take both. You know what I mean?
Well,
listen. A chassid dances whenever the spirit takes him. So, you know what I mean? Sure. All right. So, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, very important work. So significant that even Lithuanian Rabbanim ended up using a lot of his Piskei Halacha. If you ever read a Mishneh Berurah, he sometimes quotes Haraz, Reish Zayin, which is Harav Zalman, and he's referring to Rosh Ner Zalman of Ladi, and the Mishneh Berurah in a number of cases quotes the position, and the Mishneh Berurah is certainly someone very much in the classical, misnaged, Lithuanian perspective, but nonetheless he's reading the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. Then you have his collection of Igros. He was a prolific writer of letters, as were all the Lubavitcher Rebbe's following. Although I think there's something like 14 volumes of Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson's letters. Of Rav Schneer Zalman of Ladi, there are only 2 volumes of letters. That being said, they're brief, the letters. They're short. They're very readable. It's clear he... almost every word he uses is a quote of a pasuk. So if you go on the Chabad website, Chabad has the entire Chabad library up online. It's really wonderful. They footnoted every word to show you which pasuk he's quoting and where he's getting everything from. So it's really nice. So that's his Igros. And then finally, you have his Tanya, his book of the Tanya, which is obviously the classical text, not only of Chabad, but of Hasidus in general. And we're going to do a little bit of an overview of Tanya. So Tanya, by the way, just so we're all aware, Rosh Ner Zalman of Ladi did not write it in his own hand, but these were his speeches that he gave each Shabbos. Like he said, he was an exceptional darshan and educator, and there were a group of Hasidim who was their responsibility to put it all together, and they were known for having exceptional memories, and on Motzei Shabbos they would all gather together and they would put it together. So there's no reason for us not to believe that every word is authentic, because great care was taken to make sure that they got down every word. Which something's going to come up as we do more Hasidic Torah. You'll see that not all the stuff was written down exactly the same. One of the amazing things and one of the exceptional things about the Tanya is that rather being organized on the Parsha in kind of like everyone else, like we saw the Kedushas Levi, we're going to see the Noam Elimelech, we're going to see all the other ones, they're kind of haphazardly organized. Whatever the Rebbe was thinking about, you know, that week, that's what he spoke about in Shul, and those were the issues. But Rosh Ner Zalman of Ladi's Tanya is organized in a very clear and concise organization, building around one central theme, and it's extraordinarily well structured, which is why the practice is to learn it day to day. You know, there's a piece of Tanya that you learn every day, because the reason for that is because he was so structured and so organized of a thinker that he was able to put it in kind of this very linear and conceptually organized fashion. So what is in the Tanya? So we'll start with the two main sections. The section number one is Sefer HaBeinonim, and section number two is Sefer HaYichud VaHaEmuna. So what is Sefer HaBeinonim? So for those of you who aren't thinking about it, but you should because it's El time, that we all know that that on Rosh Hashanah, there's three types of people that come before God to be judged. There's Tzadikim, Rishayim, and Beinonim, right? Tzadikim, so they're decided right away for a good year. Rishayim, they are decided right away for a bad year. And then the Beinonim, they're, you know, tolin until Yom Kippur. You know, they have to wait, and sometimes even till Hoshana Rabbah, whatever it is. Okay? In the Gemara in Brachos, Daf Samach Aleph Amud Beis, it talks about who Rishayim are and who Beinonim are. So he says, Rishayim Yetzer Hara Shoftam. Rishayim, they're ruled by their Yetzer Hara. Tzadikim, they're ruled by the Yetzer Tov. And the Beinonim, the middle people, they're Zev Zeh Shoftan. Fine. That's a very sensible perspective on it. And so comes along Rabbah, and Rabbah says, Kagon ana beinoni. Rabbah says, I'm a beinoni. So Abaye looks at Rabbah, who's this great, you know, the Gadol Hador right here, and he says, Amar le Abaye, lo shavik mar chayi l'chol birya. You basically turned us all into evil people. We're all going to die now. If you're a beinoni, right, what are we? Right? If you, the Gadol Hador, are struggling, so what about the rest of us? This becomes the jumping off text for this entire section of the Tanya. Why is it a jumping off text? Because now he's able to build his theory. Number one is he says, a tzaddik, this is a special soul. What does that mean, a tzaddik is a special soul? A tzaddik is an individual who has no yetzer hara whatsoever. This is a person who is godliness, the essence of godliness in human form, however you want to call it. Okay. Again, we could complain about anthropomorphism, whatever you want to complain about, you can complain about. But that's what it is. He is a direct intermediary between man and God. He is someone who is able. Tzadik gozer v'akadosh baruch hu mekayim. This righteous person has the ability to declare something, and God must fulfill it. This tzadik is pure ruach. It's pure spirit. After that, you have the Beinoni. What is a Beinoni? A Beinoni is someone who experiences inside of him the battle of good and evil. What does Rabbah mean when he says that I'm a Beinoni? It means I experience within me the battle of good and evil. Just because I experience the battle of good and evil within me doesn't mean I don't win. Right? Rabbah, he's a winner. Right? 9 out of 10 times, Rabbah wins. The rest of us experience the same battle. Maybe we don't have the same batting average that Rabbah has, but nonetheless, we're experiencing the same battle. What's our job? Our job is to overcome, to take those two parts of ourselves, that constant battle of good and evil, what ultimately the Rebbe calls a dualism between two souls that are fighting within us. There is what he calls a nefesh bahamit. There is a animalistic soul, and then there is a nefesh elokit, there is a divine soul, both of them which are fighting within us, and our job is to accentuate the divine soul so that it wins in this battle. What is the ultimate tool to win in this battle? It says tefillah. Tefillah is one of the most powerful tools that we have in our toolkit, to be able to overcome this dualism, this fight between the two that's going on. We also have the power of our intellect, right? Of our minds, which our minds are ultimately are the direct connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have the power of our minds and the power of that mind to overcome that, the pull of our animalistic sides that has immense potential. And hence, he raises up the power of thinking, chachma, bina, and da'as. Chachma is wisdom, bina is understanding, da'as is knowledge. Hence, the name of the Hasidic sect, Chabad. Chachma Bina Da'at, which also turned it into one of the more intellectual sects amongst the Hasidim. Yes, he's raising up prayer as one of the best ways to fight it, but he's also recognizing that the study of Torah and the knowledge of Torah and the continued learning of Torah, those are opportunities that we have to overcome our Yetzer Hara in favor of our Yetzer Tov, or to take control of our animalistic soul with our divine soul. So that is kind of really the big chiddush, novelty of Sefer HaTanya.
But it's nothing that the Vilna Gaon and the Mishnagdim would disagree with.
I mean, maybe the Vilna Gaon would say, you know, Tefillah doesn't overcome it the same way. So yes, it's possible. What the Vilna Gaon thought is so... meaning there are a lot of historians who believe, right or wrong, that the Vilna Gaon decided from an initial reading what he thought of Hasidim, and he never looked at it again. And it could be that if he were to have looked at it later on, he might have come to a different conclusion. If there had been an open dialogue, he might have come to different conclusions. Then there are some people who say, no, the Vilna Gaon knew everything. You know, the Vilna Gaon was not known for being...
He doesn't come off too well.
What he depends on where you're sitting. The Vilna Gaon was known for his rigor as an intellect.
Yeah.
He left no stone unturned, and we can only assume that he read everything was out there. He read it, and he came to the conclusion that, no, this was not for me, or the Jewish people. That is very, very possible. So, however way you take it, the Vilna Gaon, again, he's not known for his lack of rigor. So one would assume that he had read everything, and if he had read everything, he still came to those conclusions. And again, if you're kind of a classic Maimonidean rationalist and you read some Hasidic stuff, you're like, "Ooh, that sounds a little bit wacky to me." Yeah. Okay, meaning the Tanya is kind of
sure, but it's not a whole lot of tolerance.
I mean, he didn't have a lot of tolerance for stupidity either. You know what I mean? So, I mean, yeah. The next part of the Tanya, also an interesting part, is Sefer Yichud VaEmuna. Here he has a very, very detailed take on Rav Yitzchak Luria's perspective on the world. If you remember, the Rav Yitzchak Luria, also known as the Ari, he has this theory on how the world is an emanation from God, how those emanations reflect or refract through different worlds, four worlds, if you want to get technical. And so the Tanya is about understanding how it refracts through those worlds. And the same thing with the soul. Each one of our souls is built up, or it refracts through those worlds. This is a very, very, very powerful and influential part of Tanya as well. Because what is this doing? This is opening up what used to be a very, very particularistic experience, reserved for very, very few people, the understanding of the Kabbalistic system of the world, and it's opening it up to the entirety of the world. And this is a very powerful moment here as well. And again, now he has all of his Hasidim doing it, and there's thousands of people coming to hear him give the lectures on these issues. So therefore, it becomes a much more popular text. And this is also something that may have caused the Vilna Gaon's fear, which is the broad learning of Kabbalah was also one of the features of Shabtai Tzvi. Right, that all of a sudden that everyone is studying Kabbalah, and Shabtai Tzvi is telling everyone to do Aveira Lishma, and it's becoming something that was a horrible experience for the Jewish people. And obviously also hindsight is 20/20. You know, we look back now and Hasidim turned out to be a wonderful complement to the Jewish experience, something we look back with, particularly for those of us who have family from Poland or Russia, etc. We look back kind of with a fondness and a nostalgia for those days. But, in the heat of the moment, one could certainly understand why someone like the Vilna Gaon might be not looking so nostalgically upon the broad learning of Kabbalah. Okay, so that is the Tanya in a nutshell. A number of wonderful books have been written on it. For those of you who are looking to understand it, I know the Koren has almost finished publishing, I think, all of Steinsaltz's English commentary on the Tanya. It's very, very readable. Some of it is going to be like, whoa, you know, like a little wacky. And some of it will be like, yeah, you know, so it's, I mean, I told you some of the audience, I don't want to call it wacky because, you know, thousands of people are big believers in it. But the notion of understanding us in not, you know, we're used to dualistic terms. You know, there's body and soul. There's, you know, there's earth and there's heaven. But this is not written in dualistic. This is, everything is in fours. You know, so all of a sudden, your soul is nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, chida, or fives even. And you know, the light of God unfolds through those different souls until it reaches you. Ruach is the most... nefesh and ruach are the most ones that you can feel. As you get into chai yechida, those are beyond your understanding, but you're nonetheless connected to it. There are portions of chassidut which seem almost to be deterministic in their perspective. And some of that stuff comes out in there also, that to a certain extent, free will is imagined. And you think it is, but really you're just a tool of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So your actions are by definition His will, which means actions, good and bad, are His will. So you know, you find things like that in terms of the way life unfolds through this world, how we experience the world. It unfolds through these, you know, groupings of worlds. The God that we talk to is a God who's refracted through these worlds. These are things that are difficult, I think, for the modern mind to comprehend, although it could be that for the postmodern mind, it seems that Chassidus in its intellectual form is making a comeback. So it could be. Yeah, yeah. And Tanya is this influential work. It's behind so much of the Hasidic works that happen later on. It's not like, you know, the Kutzker or Rav Tzadok or even Tzio Shalom or any of them are not going to quote the Alter Rebbe. He was such an influential person. Chabad Hasidus as a social movement has kind of differentiated itself from other Hasidus. But as an intellectual movement, it's very much in line, if not the forebearer, for a lot of the Hasidic thought that comes later on.
Shneur Zalman was like two generations down from...
So the Baal Shem Tov, Maggid of Mezrich, then Shneur Zalman. He's the youngest of the third generation. Okay, so I have a little bit of time, so let's read one of his letters here about tefillah. So I'm going to start from the second or third line here. Hinei af ki lo yidatiu v'lo akir mame'eu, ach lo shema ozen shmatiu, asher ruach Hashem nosasabo. So he says, even though the person he's writing to, I don't know you, I don't know what you look like, I've never heard your voice. But I know, I can tell, that the Spirit of God is in you. And that Spirit is, Shalom la'amod besod misachakim ha'maligim ha'chafitzim la'avod es Hashem. And he says, and I know you're not going to be one of those people who hangs out with those who ridicule those who want to serve God. The MS who in truth, avoda shebelev, in worship of the heart, zo tefillah. Ki adam rama batorah gumilas chasen umidya mi yitem v'aya lahem ze b'mes kol ha'yamim. He says, because they're people of great Torah, of great kindness, and I wish they were like that all the time. So those are the people you should be hanging out. Ach ata avru toros, chalfu chok bihivastam yachad, alei ligzor gzerot shmad ala tfila, lispalel kamosa. He says, but what's happening? He says, these same people who were once, you know, good, kind, wonderful people, now they have a decree that everyone should daven just like them. So here he's writing encouragement to chassidim, who are davening a different nusach, they're davening nusach Ari, as opposed to the more normative, probably nusach Ashkenaz, that was going on around. He says, but and what do they want? They want them to daven just like them, b'chipazon, quickly, uvalu blishum tenua, without chuckling, v'haramas kol, and without, you know, raising their voices, kamalachei elyon bagyan madrei ga ha'elyonasha in lamala imenu. But when you raise your voice, you reach a height that there's no one above it. Kemasha kasav v'amona tarpana kanfeim. Va'av gamze bekata elyona hanikraim srafim v'lo b'shar kitot. Kemosha kasav v'ofenim chayat hakodesh b'rash gadol. He says, you see, he says, how do the angels in the highest of the high, how do they daven? They daven birash gadol, with great noise. So we should also daven with great noise. V'gam b'sraphim, with the seraphim, who are even higher, kol hamula. V'gam b'tnuot mishonot, they also move around in all different directions. K'muvu arba piyutim, al piyu perke lachos, as is in the poetry. V'lachein ein raya mi tzadikim arishonin shayu gedolim mi malachin sharis. Aval ana yatme diatme ola bedatam li damot lahem ein ze ki'im roa lev v'sheker biminam. V'gam ha'omrim tvi... So he says, don't listen to them. We can only do what we can do. He says, v'gam ha'omrim tfila mi darabanan. He says, and those people who say that our over-accentuation of prayer is bad, because prayer is only a rabbinic requirement, lo ra'u me'orot mi'mehem. Ki af shenutzach ha'tfila u'minyana gimel pa'amim bayom hu midrabanan. He says it's true that the text of tfila and the fact that we daven three times a day, that is derabanan. Ikar inyana u'mahuta hu yesod kol ha'Torah. That's the basis of the entire Torah, right? The essence of tfila. La das es Hashem, to know God. Lakir godlo v'tifarto b'dei ha'shalem ma'um yushaves, to recognize his greatness and his beauty and his majesty with full knowledge, um yushaves, b'bina ha'leiv, sh'isponim z'ekokach, ad sh'tisorer nefesh ha'maskeles la'avas ha'shem ha'shem, l'davka bo, u'v'torah so lachbots me'od v'mitzvosav asher kol inyan zeh na'aseh lanu mizman hazeh, Ayidim Amiras Psuke Dzimra, Ubrachos, Kriya Shema Lefanev, Lacharecha, Bifem Ale, Bekol Amirer, Kavanas Ale, Bekulehai. So he says, listen, he says, it's true, the three davenings that we say every day, Pashachas Mincha Ma'ariv, that specificity, that's the Rabbanan. But the tefillah itself, the notion of prayer, that is a biblical requirement, because how else are you going to inspire your soul to know God, to be close, to have dvekas with God, to meet with God, to desire to be close with Him, if you don't say Psukei Dezimra, if you don't say Shema, if you don't say the Tzvila. He says, and Mashenkin Rav Shimon Bar Yochai v'chaverav. He says, it's true, there was a group of people, or Shimon Bar Yochai and his friends. Hayadai lahem b'kriya Shema levad. They could get away with just saying Shema. L'chol imyan zayya shenikne lahem bashkafa rishona b'shiflus aleva nema b'briso itam. That's because they had a special connection with God. They didn't need it. Aval b'zman hazeh. But in this day and age, kol ha'karov el Hashem v'tam tam tefila pam achas. Anyone who tasted tefila even just once. Yavin v'yaskir ki bilada lo yarim ish es yado v'etzraglo l'avod Hashem b'emes. You understand that you can't serve God without it. You can't serve God truthfully without proper prayer. Ki mitzvas anashim elu muda, right? This is what has been taught to us, and the Satan is trying to stop us from involving ourselves in tefillah. Va'kein, and therefore he says, kol divrei aigeres hazos bati. I brought this entire letter. I come le'orer nefesh nidiba le'bosh bigdei kinah. I'm trying to take your sincere souls to rise up in jealousy, lekanot l'Hashem l'torato, to basically to be jealous on behalf of God, la'afer machshavot arumim v'lo tasena yedeyem toshia v'techashev lo tzaka l'dor v'dor. You have to encourage the people that their hands will not be weakened. Ad olam k'shamru rabotinu ilu ne'amar arur asher lo yaseh lo ayat kumah l'sonei Yisrael. Achshav she'ne'amar arur asher lo yakim kol machzik u'makim ha'osim ma'ale alav ha'kasuv ki ilu kol ha'torah kiyem kol ha'torah kula. He points out, he says, words of Chazal, that because it said, curse it to those who don't follow this, it becomes that much more of a blessing for those who do follow it. So he says, because there are those who are telling you not to follow this path of prayer, it becomes that much more of a blessing for those of you who do. So this is in a nutshell, Roshner Zalman of Vladi, really a nutshell. He was one of the most influential people in history. You see, by the way, just to see how powerful of an experience it was, is that to this day, Chabad Hasidus retains that kind of administrative, bureaucratic organization that he set up, you know, all those years ago, way back in the 1700s. It continues to this day. And also the Rebbe as CEO also continues to this day. So that's all very much established by the Baal HaTanya, by the Roshner Zalman of Vladi, the Alter Rebbe, whatever it is, whatever name it is that you call him. But he's someone who is extraordinarily influential throughout history. And again, he's worth our time. Some of the stuff is less than accessible for those who are not experienced in Hasidic lore or in Hasidic thought. However, much of it is very accessible. And I told you, the Steinsaltz books make it a little bit easier. Rabbi Steinsaltz is a very clear clear author and educator as well, and he's someone who's able to really explain things for the modern reader. So if you're looking for something that's to read to get involved in it, so you can start with the 13-Petaled Rose or the Long Shorter Way, both of which are books that are built off of the Tanya. They're written in very clear English. And have been published recently. So questions, comments?
These letters were written down. Were they available to people afterwards? I'm thinking specifically about the Karliners. You know, you were talking about the noise, Barash Gadol, right?
Yeah.
You know, they would make all this noise. Would they take this kind of teaching to make noise?
So one thing the Lubavitchers were very good at was getting out everything that the Rebbe was saying, because again he realized that as one person there's only so much contact he could have, so they wrote down everything, and people were reading it, and that's why he becomes a lightning rod for misnagdic criticism, is because people were reading it.
And one other biographical biography on the first side. It says in November 9th, 1800, arrested again on accusations of Sabbateanism.
So
arrested by who?
So you realize the Jews were a recognized religion within Russia, and so they could. Sabbateanism is associated with the Ottoman Empire again. So they are accusing him. So he was arrested again. He had a rough life, the Alter Rebbe. He had two major run-ins with the authorities.
That may be why he had only two books.
I mean, Hasidim weren't that prolific as it was. So you know, he wrote more than most of his other contemporaries. The only ones he had to blame were other Jews who were turning him in. Yeah, it wasn't like what's it called? I forget which one. I think it was the Mitla Rebbe, which is the second or the third Rebbe. I don't remember. So he had to run off. He was hid. So Chaslavich, which is a big Lubavitcher, or was a big Lubavitcher community in Lithuania, always hired a non-Lubavitcher rabbi to be their rabbi. Why? Because tradition had it that the Mitla Rebbe was running away. And from the Tsarist authorities, and the Misnagdish rabbi hit him in his house. And the Tsarist police came and knocked on the door, and he opened up, and they said, "Are you hiding the Rebbe?" And he said, I'm the Misnagdish rabbi. He said, "If I knew where the Rebbe was, I would tell you, I'd hand him over to you myself." And he hid the Rebbe in his basement or something. And saved the Rebbe's life. So from then on, they only hired non-Hasidic rabbis for the shul to be grateful for that. And one of the non-Hasidic rabbis was Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's father of Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the rabbi of Chaslavich, which is why the Rav Soloveitchik, because he was raised in that little area which had a lot of Hasidim, his first malamid ended up teaching him Tanya instead of Gemara. Which is why he always had a deep love for the Book of Tanya because of his Rebbe, or his Cheder Rebbe from all those years.
So there's tefillah is very important, and yet he designs Nusach Ari, which is somewhat different from the other Hasidic Nusach.
No, everyone is davening Nusach. Ari was the Nusach.
And where did Nusach Svad came after Ari?
I think so. Yeah, Nusach Ari. They chose Nusach Ari because it was more in line with Kabbalistic meditations. That's why they switched to Nusach Ari. Nusach Svad is just a takeoff on Nusach Ari.
I thought it was the other way around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
So the Maggid actually learned, actually davened in Nusach Ari, you're saying?
I don't know. I never met. I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea. I know. Yeah. Nusach Svard is how it came about is a complicated issue, to the point where many poskim were like Rav Moshe Feinstein has a famous tshuva where someone writes to him where he says, "What should I do?" He said, "My father davens Nusach Svard, but I went to yeshiva and they taught me how to daven Nusach Ashkenaz. So how should I daven?" So Rav Moshe says, you should daven Nusach Ashkenaz. And he says, you shouldn't worry about changing your minhag. He says, because they weren't allowed to start davening Nusach Svard in the first place. So just to know how long that lasted. So that was a long time. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm not an expert on Arya Kaplan, but, you know, and I read it with a layman's head.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like there's a lot of these concepts that you've been talking about over the weeks appear in his books.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so Ari Kaplan, from what I understand, is built off of Lurianic Kabbalah, the Ari's Kabbalah, but Hasidus is also built off of the Ari's Kabbalah, so it would make sense that they would both be dealing with the same type of concepts.
Sure. Hmm?